Let me now hand the microphone over to Deborah Glass, the Victorian Ombudsman, to take us through the role of the Ombudsman's Office, but also to talk through the recent report produced by the Ombudsman. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you very much. I also want to pay my respects to traditional owners of this land and their elders, past and present, and can also pay my respects to the advocacy sector, because I think you do an absolutely amazing job. I'm really happy to be at something that you've called a conversation, because I hope that this will be a conversation. And what I want to do this morning is talk a bit about my office generally, as well as the investigation report that I tabled. But I'd also be very keen to hear from you about what you think, because I'm still got phase two to come, and I'm not going to say a great deal about that. We've had a lot of evidence thus far, but I'd be very interested actually in some of your thoughts about where you think it's going and what your reaction was to what I've tabled so far. But if I can, let me just start with the very sad case of Ms. J. An older woman, intellectual disability, unable to communicate verbally, dependent on staff in a supported residential service for her personal care, and she's been in this facility for the last 9 years. She has no family at all. And one day she's found crawling semi-naked out of another resident's room. Now, lots of things happened following that. VCAT granted the public advocate temporary guardianship order, police got involved, they found evidence of indecent assault, and eventually charges were laid. But the people in that supported residential service were the only people around to look after Ms. J's interests. Now, they did actually, in this case, respond appropriately, and the public advocate described them as being very protective of Ms. J. But you know, some real questions came to, you know, were asked about what was she doing in that facility, and how could she have been there for the last 9 years, and really, who was looking after her interests? And I think what that case illustrated very powerfully for me was why we need advocates and why the system needs advocacy. And sadly, and there are many, a pretty brutally clear illustration of why I launched this investigation into the reporting and investigation of abuse in the disability sector. What I'd like to talk about briefly before I go into the details of the investigation is a bit about what my office does. Because to understand how we can help people like Ms. J, you actually need to know what does the Ombudsman do? What role do we have? And what powers do we have to get involved? And basically, I'm not going to say a great deal about the role of the Ombudsman, but it's fundamentally about the imbalance of power between the individual and the state. The role was set up, and it goes back to, in Victoria, to 1973. And it's part of that movement that was created in the 70s because of the increasing imbalance. And you, I think, more than many, many people will have a really good understanding of what I mean about the imbalance of power between people, the individual, and people, and the bureaucracy. So, to reflect that, what I want to do in this role is provide a voice for all Victorians to be able to express their grievances with the bureaucracy, with the people in power. Because I think that this role is about fairness. I want everybody in Victoria to know that they should expect to be treated fairly in their dealings with government, and to know that they can complain if they're not, and that complaining is actually very, very important. And to do that, I've actually begun, and it's only very early days for me, going out across the state. I've been in the last 6 months, I have been to East Gippsland. Last week I was in Shepparton and Benalla. Last month I was in Mildura and Swan Hill. Been out to Warrnambool in the middle of winter. And it's all been very cold, but it's actually that the purpose of that is to get the message out, first of all, and I know there are people present not just from Melbourne, and that's wonderful, and my message is that I am the Victorian Ombudsman, I am not the Ombudsman for Melbourne, and I think that everybody in Victoria needs to understand what the office can do and how we can help them, and indeed also how we can't, because there are limitations as well. And I'm very conscious when I'm doing that, that it is by and large the most vulnerable people in our state who need the services of the office the most and are the least likely to have heard of them. And they are people that you deal with, among others. So you are also a very important audience for me, because if you can understand what the office does and how it can help, then those are messages that you also can communicate. Now, what I'd like to do is to play you a very short video, if I've managed to load this correctly, because we created this just in the last month, and it's on our website, and it's something that now almost replaces me standing up for half an hour explaining what we do, and this does it in 2.5 minutes.
Welcome to the Victorian Ombudsman. We deal with complaints about more than 1,000 state and local government agencies, from councils and prisons to statutory bodies like VicRoads and WorkSafe. Our role is to make sure their decision-making is fair. In weighing that up, we look at the circumstances surrounding a complaint, including what the law is and the agency's policies and procedures. If you think you've been treated unfairly, the first step is to try and resolve your problem with the agency. If that doesn't work, you can contact us. You don't have to be over 18, and you can remain anonymous. In some cases, another person can complain for you. You can complain to us about something an agency did or didn't do, or a decision it made. For example, if you made a complaint but the agency is taking months to respond, or the agency says they've fixed the problem but you're still not satisfied, or they've made a decision that you think is unfair. You can also come to us if you feel an agency has infringed your human rights. We understand you may be feeling frustrated by the time you speak to us. Try to explain your complaint in a few key points, including what happened and when. Tell us what you'd like to happen, and remember to send us relevant documents. We'll assess your complaint and decide on a course of action. If we think we can help, we'll try to resolve the matter informally, and in some cases, we investigate further. When we're finished, we might make recommendations to the agency on how it can improve. In some cases, we'll present our findings to Parliament, so the public knows what we've said and the lessons can be learnt by the whole state government. By helping government agencies to improve, we create a better experience for everyone. We don't deal with complaints about the police, courts, politicians, or employment issues. There are some other limits on what we can do too. For example, if your complaint is very old, or there is another body that can deal with it. If you're not sure what to do next, get in touch and we'll try to point you in the right direction. You can find out more about where we can and can't help on our website. Otherwise, you can email, call, write to us, or make a time to come in and see us. Head to ombudsman.vic.gov.au for more details. The Victorian Ombudsman. Free, fair, independent.
What do you think? Useful? It's on our website. Feel free to take a look for yourself. Feel free to link to it if that would be useful to you in any of your own materials. But that's, you know, very much part of my overall vision for my term of office, about ensuring people actually understand the role of the office and what we can do, and using those complaints to drive improvements in public administration. Because every complaint actually is free feedback. And my message when I talk to the public sector is that. It's not necessarily about an ombudsman's investigation, because actually I'm not going to, indeed can't investigate the thousands, tens of thousands of complaints we get. But every one of those complaints is feedback, and every one of them is a picture of somebody's dissatisfaction. So that's available, incidentally, in Auslan as well. It's also, we have it in subtitles in Chinese, Vietnamese and Somali. We've got it in Burmese and Karen, and it's coming soon in Farsi and Arabic. So any other thoughts that people have on that video and what we can do, really be keen to hear what you have to say. Now, I'd just like to briefly say a bit about how that works in practice, and how the office works in practice, just to put some context on that. And this is a snapshot that's been taken from the annual report that I tabled in Parliament just a couple of weeks ago, because I've just completed my first full year in office. And that full year has been a busy one. Last year, over 38,000 people contacted my office. And that's without doing, you know, all the outreach that I have planned to do. That's really when I've only just started. Now, of those 38,000 people, lots of people complain about things that I can't do anything about, because what I find is that people have heard about the Ombudsman vaguely in terms of complaints, but they actually aren't very sure what the Ombudsman does. And there are lots of other Ombudsmen also in Victoria, so people complain to me about their telephone bills, and we send them to the Telecommunications Ombudsman. Or people complain about, and I am not making this up, their KFC chips were cold. You know, we do actually have a call centre, and you know, I do listen in on the phones every month to get a feeling for what people are saying when they contact the office, and we do get some pretty odd ones. So we do also provide something of a public service in sending people to the right direction, which is very often consumer affairs. But you know, of those tens of thousands of complaints, and again, numbers of them are also premature, because people will complain to us about things where they haven't actually complained first to the agency. So the advice we always give, if you've got a complaint about Department of Human Services, the you know, local council or whoever, have you complained to them first? Because you need to give them a chance to resolve it. And if you have, and they haven't resolved it, by all means, come back to us. But if you haven't, please go back to them and make your complaint to them and give them an opportunity to address it. So what we also see from that is the thousands of cases that we do actually make formal inquiries in. So last year, 3,256 formal inquiries were carried out. And those are cases that range from the sorts of things that we can deal with pretty much in a day. Example is, you know, somebody might complain about the Office of Housing. You know, we get people who ring up and say, my boiler is broken down and I've complained to the Office of Housing and they've just done nothing about it. And we'll make a phone call to the Office of Housing and it will be fixed. So, you know, it's sort of, it shouldn't take a phone call to the Ombudsman, but it does, and it's something that we can deal with pretty quickly without the need for any kind of formal investigation or file review. But they also range from those cases that can be resolved quickly through to cases that we will, you know, we do take months over. You know, we will go and review departmental files, we will look at documentation, and everything in between. So of those thousands of cases, and sometimes we'll conclude that we think that what the agency did was reasonable. So, you know, either whatever we do, we're forming an independent view that we based on the evidence, and we'll assess the cases that come in. There's a relatively small number of formal investigations that my office does. I'm not hugely resourced for the tens of thousands of cases that come in. I have a total of 86 staff, and that's a full-time equivalent actually of 80 to deal with all of that. So it's a relatively small number of formal investigations that I'm able to start every year, and many of those relate to protected disclosures that I am obliged to investigate under our current integrity system. But of those, I do a even smaller number of major systemic inquiries, and the two main examples in the first year of my term were the investigation that I tabled not long ago about rehabilitation of prisoners in Victoria, which some of you may be aware of, and the investigation that I'm going to talk about a bit more today into the reporting investigation of abuse in the disability sector. So just to put the work of the office into context, tens of thousands of complaints a year. I have jurisdiction over 1,000 government departments and agencies, and out of those, we drill down into relatively few. But the key one, and I will turn now straight to it, is the investigation into the reporting investigation of abuse in the disability sector. Has everybody seen the report that I tabled in June into that? I'm seeing a few nods, or read, or otherwise heard of, or familiar with. Yep, okay, that's good to know. So, a bit of a recap on why I launched it. I think I'm probably stating this to, you know, the obvious to this audience. When I came into this role last year, one of the things that I was asking, because although I grew up in Victoria, I've been out of the country for about 30 years, and I'm not, you know, I didn't come into this role familiar with the issues that face the state. I came in very familiar with the issues around complaints and investigations, because I've been dealing with police complaints and corruption in the UK for quite some time before coming into this role. But the specific issues around Victoria, I was getting briefings from my staff and from people outside and asking the question, you know, what are the issues, what are the patterns, what are the themes? And in addition to prisons, which is, you know, has always been the largest source of complaints to the office, I was looking at what else do people complain about and where has the office been before and where are some places that I think we need to go. So I was asking questions about disability when I first came into the role. Although it wasn't an enormous area of complaint, and I do want to stress this, but we, you know, we were getting some complaints from the disability sector, not a huge number, but certainly some, and I was looking at the ones coming in and thinking, I'd like us to do some scoping around that. So we were scoping the issues in the disability sector around the time that that Four Corners and The Age, you know, ran their exposés on Urala and other scandals in November of last year. So all of that came to a head for me around saying this is a considerable area of public importance and this is something that I think I need to look at. So I launched that investigation in December of last year. And, you know, what I said when I launched it is something that I repeat, and I think, you know, is incredibly important, that, you know, that abuse of people with a disability is unconscionable in a civilized society. And that what we'd seen from, you know, from the reporting and the issues that had come to light is that something is broken, something is wrong with our systems, we need to understand what is broken and what can be done to fix it. So fundamentally, that was what I went out with in December of last year. I also said at the time that we needed to examine the effectiveness of those charged with oversight and to highlight areas where there is no oversight at all. And I was very mindful when I did that of the impact of the upcoming National Disability Insurance Scheme. And it seemed all the more important that we look at the issues around oversight, because if we don't have a robust mechanism in place now, what hope are we going to have for the future when, you know, these matters may well all fall to the Commonwealth? So what I was keen to do at the outset, when I launched this investigation last year, was not to launch it with an immediate set of terms of reference. I actually wanted to find out from people what people thought the priorities needed to be. And I had to weigh that up with what I felt that my office could achieve with the resources available and in the time frame that was practical. So I asked for submissions and we got 78. We got some really excellent and very, very powerful submissions. And from that developed the terms of reference of the investigation. And you know, for those who can see the screen, that includes the terms of reference in Easy English that we also published at the time. Now, I also include in there, and I included in this when I went out with the terms of reference in March of this year, this quote from Inclusion Melbourne, which I thought was really very powerful. And I will just read this for your benefit. You know, what has occurred and been reported in the media is a product of the culture in which we live. If this inquiry enables our community to rethink our casual, culturally ingrained ideas about who is a human, who is afforded rights, and who is supported to access justice, then this will serve as the best way to prevent anything like this from ever happening again. And I thought that was a particularly powerful quote from the sector. So, what did the investigation actually find? I'm aware that you will have seen the report. What I'm going to just take you through is what I pulled out from this as the key issues that we identified. And I think the first really critical one is, you know, you when you come to this, you ask the question, you know, how bad is the problem? How do I understand the scale of abuse in the sector? And one of the things that came through with all the investigating we were doing, all the search through of the numbers and the data, was that actually we don't know. The system doesn't know, because there isn't a consistent and coherent way of recording any of these things, and there's no requirement to do so. And they're called so many different things in so many parts of the system. So there's no single source of information. There is no common framework. So the starting point, which sort of came through during the investigation, was actually, we don't even know. And I put this up, you know, we interviewed numbers of people for this, in the immortal words of somebody from the department, we don't know what we don't know. Yep, that's true, isn't it? But how bad is that? And what does that say? So the lack of mandatory reporting is one of the things that, you know, that came through very clearly as an issue. Because without mandatory reporting, we don't know what we don't know, right? So up there as an issue. The second key issue that came through, and these are in no particular order of importance because they're all, you know, in my view, very important, was simply how incredibly complicated the system was. And I'm probably overstating it even to call it a system. One of my staff spent quite a lot of time trying to map this. And we put this into the report. And for those who can't see the slide, I can tell you that to call this a dog's breakfast is, I'd say, an insult to, you know, certainly the dog's breakfasts that I've seen, which are relatively neat, because it isn't. You know, it is a web of lines jumbling from here to there about what, who does what, who's responsible for what, who knows what. And it's, how complicated is that? And if it's complicated, you know, for somebody like me, or, you know, for people who are, who work in the sector, if it's complicated for those of us who are active in this, how much more complicated is it for people with disabilities? So the fact that it is so complicated and so confusing and so hard to understand, which body is responsible? That certainly struck me as a very important issue. So, you know, what are the gaps? Well, there are plenty of them. You know, what I said at the outset is that I want to understand the overlaps and the gaps. Well, there's lots of overlaps and there are lots of gaps. The Disability Services Commissioner and OPA are the only bodies that have a specific oversight role, and they both have their limitations. Various things, one doesn't have jurisdiction over, others they don't. They don't have own motion powers. And indeed, the Disability Services Commissioner, as I said in the report, was loath to use the powers it does have. And one of the really big issues, though, that comes through all of this is the lack of ownership. You know, who's actually leading on this? Who is responsible for this? And what you find is a lot of well-meaning people in the sector. You know, you find, you know, within agencies, within departments, people who really are doing their best, who really are trying to promote the rights of people with a disability. But actually, nobody owns it. So nobody exercises the leadership that needs to happen if something is actually going to change. Which entity is responsible for education and prevention? You know, we have an example of the guidelines developed by the Office of the Public Advocate on interagency guidelines on neglect and abuse. But actually, they're not adopted by the department, when they're not mandatory, and they don't apply to everyone. So you have no sense of a system that is coherent. And actually, and what came through very, very strongly for us in looking at this is that the response to abuse was dependent on where you were within the system, not the problem. So it was not victim-centred. It was not about the victim and what happened to them. It was driven by, well, were you in an SRS, or were you in a DAS home, or were you in a community service organisation, and if so, which one? Because they all had different requirements, different systems in place, different procedures. So all of these things were saying that nothing was consistent, nothing was coherent, and it was not, fundamentally, not victim-centred. Lack of information sharing. I mean, this is a problem that occurs not only in this sector. It's something that I have commented on time and time again, going back to previous roles dealing with the police in the UK. You know, this is all too often government agencies and departments operate in silos and they simply don't talk to each other. Sometimes they can't. Sometimes there are the most absurd barriers. My office is one of them. You know, there are barriers in information that I can share. I am bound by overly restrictive confidentiality laws in my act that prevent me from sharing information, including, for example, with the Human Rights Commission. You know, so some of these things are simply around barriers that should not be there. Sometimes they're barriers that we create. But for instance, the department doesn't publish types of incident reports received. They don't publish numbers of incident reports, a location or within a particular service. What do they do with the information that they get around incident reporting? Well, how does it drive improvements in the sector? This is what comes out very, very strongly. So what are some of the key issues that actually drive improvements? Well, it's good data. It's actually being able to analyse the data of incidents. So you need to know that what's happened. What was the incident? What are the patterns there? What are the themes that come out of that? And what can we do to deal with it? You know, they highlight problems, they highlight issues. And if those dots aren't joined because they're captured in different parts of the system, then you're not going to have any improvement strategies because people don't know what needs to be improved. And therefore, how are you going to prevent this from happening again? So all of these things come through very, very strongly in the evidence that we took. We looked at advocacy, and that was something that also came through very strongly in the evidence, that there was no understanding of how much advocacy was necessary. And we were asking these questions, you know, how many people in the system are really vulnerable? Well, you know, have you assessed the need for advocacy? Well, no, you know, there's a limited amount of funding in the sector, very limited amount, as you more than anybody would be able to say. And it's funded by the department. And it seemed to me, and I've said this in the report, that there is an inherent conflict in the department funding advocacy for people who are reliant on departmental services. That just doesn't strike me as being a good idea. And the department has so many roles. It funds advocacy. That's a very small part of its role. It's a regulator of SRSs. It's a provider of services to DAS homes. It's a funder through community service organisations. It's doing all of these things. And there is a certain amount of, to me, inherent tension within those roles that I think needs to be addressed. So we looked at a number of other, you know, we looked at experience elsewhere, and we included in the report the New South Wales model. And I don't put up the New South Wales model, which where the responsibilities are with my counterpart in New South Wales, the ombudsman there, as to say this is something that I think Victoria must do, but to put it up as a way of how these things can work. Because New South Wales is actually the only state with a legislated system of an independent review of incidents. There is mandatory reporting in New South Wales of incidents, reporting to the Ombudsman, all notifiable incidents, and investigations are conducted either by the department or the agencies and monitored by the Ombudsman, who can also conduct his own investigations. Now, New South Wales is different from Victoria because New South Wales doesn't have a Disability Services Commissioner. It actually sits within the Ombudsman's office. So, you know, this is historically a very different model from the one we have here. But what that has done is create a coherent system where the parts of the oversight systems actually are all within the same body. We also looked at the impact of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and I was very conscious when I was doing this report that, and this was part of the reason for the timing of it, focusing on oversight in phase one, that at the time I announced this, you know, the NDIS hadn't actually put out its consultation paper on safeguards. And there was a time frame on that, and I wanted that safeguarding paper to be informed by the work of this report. So that was, you know, part of what was driving this. We don't know, we simply do not yet know, and maybe you'll hear more about it this afternoon, what the thinking is around the safeguarding under the NDIS. But what sort of came across very powerfully for me in doing this investigation is that what we have in Victoria at the moment is not good enough. There are too many gaps. It is too fragmented. There are too many people who fall between the cracks. It's too complicated. And it's not right. We can't expect people to actually, you know, we can't wait for a system to be developed in 2019. And anyway, how do we know that system is going to be better than the one we have now? So what we need to do is ensure that we identify what needs to make a good oversight system, a good safeguarding system in Victoria. We need to get that to happen. And we need to ensure that parts of that the elements of safeguarding are then appropriately transferred into the NDIS. So, you know, what were the key findings? Well, I pretty much set them out. The system is fundamentally failing, I think, to protect people with disabilities. The oversight arrangements are fragmented, they're complicated, they're confusing, and there's a lack of ownership. Little clarity about who is responsible for what, overlapping responsibilities and gaps. And what we found is that problems are regularly raised, including by lots of well-meaning people, but they're not, very rarely are they fixed. And doing nothing, and I said this, you know, very strongly in the report, while waiting for a national scheme is not an option. So what were the recommendations? I spent a lot of time thinking about recommendations because it's very, you know, I can't enforce my recommendations. So I can say whatever I like. But I'm a great believer in making recommendations that are practical and that are capable of implementation. And I was very mindful when I was doing this, that if I recommended, you know, some huge new set of arrangements in Victoria, it wasn't going to happen because by the time, even if that was accepted in principle, the reality is it would take years to set up, by which time this is all going to be transferred to the NDIS anyway. So is it going to happen? I think the answer is no. So what I wanted to do was recommend the principles. These are the elements that you actually need to think about in oversight. So yes, there should be, in principle, a single independent oversight body for the reporting of allegations of abuse in the disability sector. Now, and it should have a number of elements that included mandatory reporting. What I also said is that you can take the elements of that and ensure, you know, if you don't want to create the body itself, ensure that those elements sit within the existing system in a way that is properly joined up, that actually gets rid of the gaps and the overlapping on the boundaries, that makes sure that you have information sharing that actually links these things together. So the recommendations I made were essentially big picture principle recommendations as opposed to the hundreds of recommendations that I might have made about, you know, areas of detail. And as I said, phase two is yet to come. What I wanted was focus on the big picture. So the big picture, two recommendations. One was around oversight and the other was around advocacy, because that powerful point that came through was that the system needs far more advocacy than it has at the moment, that there are so many vulnerable people out there. And the system has not actually estimated the need for this. And particularly, and this comes through very, very strongly in the NDIS trial in Barwon, the need for advocacy of people with a disability is, I think, from what I've heard, is actually far greater than people recognised when that started. And who has assessed that need? You know, who has said, actually, what do we need to do here in order to properly safeguard the rights of people with disability? Well, nobody has. So my recommendation was around funding that actually starts with an informed assessment about the need. So where are I with those recommendations? Well, I can, you know, the fine words from the minister, used to those. Any abuse is abhorrent and we must take steps to assure it ends. There we are. So what are they going to do about the recommendations? Well, as you know, there's also a parliamentary inquiry. You know, much of what I am doing is actually hoping to inform that parliamentary inquiry, because ultimately, you know, what happens, what is decided around oversight bodies, what is it decided about funding, they're matters for Parliament. You know, it is for them to determine how this is going to work. But, you know, that, you know, the key issues here around, you know, we need action. So if there's phase two still to come. Parliamentary inquiry, as you know, is ongoing, and my intention is to table phase two before the end of the year and to ensure that that informs the overall work of that inquiry. So what we need to know is, you know, but the key issue here, and I've said this time and time again, is to, if we really want to address an issue of this magnitude, you know, where the landscape is so fragmented and the system is really, you know, so broken, we actually have to drill down at each area that needs attention. We need to ensure the foundations are secure and they're operating. There's still a lot of work to be done, and that's very much, I think, over to others. And I think, you know, the heavy lifting will begin after I table phase two of that report. Because all too often, I just leave you with this thought, what I've seen, and we saw this time and time again in this investigation, is that investigations will result in a review that simply confirms the problem. We know what the problem is. And the example that I've seen, and we see this painfully, is the department's incident reporting system. The Ombudsman reported on that, I think it was, you know, about 10 years ago. And the response was to review it. And the review confirms there's a problem with the incident reporting system. And then there's another, you know, and then something else happens, or the Auditor General publishes a report, and the response is to have another review, which confirms that there is, guess what, a problem with the incident reporting system. But they haven't fixed the incident reporting system. And that can't be right. So I'm leaving them with a few challenges, and there'll be probably a few more challenges in phase two, because for the sake of people with disabilities in Victoria, we cannot wait any longer to fix this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Deborah. We now have about 15 minutes where we can hear questions from those of you who are present. So Lee is going to be our microphone runner. When you do get the microphone, please just say your name and the organisation that you're representing. And if you do have a question, please raise your hand now.
Thanks, Deborah, for that presentation. I'm Jen from Women with Disabilities Victoria, and I was just wondering from your inquiries what you've found the incident reporting system could do to respond more to individuals' experiences. So in terms of currently the system focuses on the allegation and investigating that, but what have you found is lacking for the person who's disclosed abuse in that situation?
That's very much the focus of phase two, and I mentioned the constraints on my legislation, and I'd love to talk to you about phase two, because phase two is actually looking at in much more of the individual experience. You know, what actually happened to people when they reported abuse, what happened to whistleblowers when they came forward. So we are actually looking at all of these issues, and I am looking at, you know, what could we do to make that better? So you'll forgive me if I can't tell you now what I think that response should be, but do rest assured that this is absolutely the focus of that second part of the investigation. And I'm interested in your thoughts on this, actually. So if those of you who have experience of this have thoughts on how you think the system would work better, I would welcome that.
Tony Tregow from Lisa Incorporated. Whilst totally agreeing with everything you've said, our experience of your office is that they consider the bureaucrats know best. Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. I mean, and I don't actually, I mean, I obviously you will have your own views on that, and I'm not going to, it wouldn't be right for me to comment on individual cases. I think the record of the office in looking at these matters, well, first of all, let me just make a point about jurisdiction, because sometimes people complain to my office directly about abuse, and I can't always deal with it, because it does depend, it's a very complicated scenario about whether the office actually has jurisdiction to deal with these sorts of cases. But if somebody complains about the department, for instance, we will, depending on the circumstances, review what the department has done. And I think we do this with a pretty questioning eye. Sorry, that's not your experience. It's certainly been the experience of others. And what I welcome, though, also is feedback. You know, if people don't think we're doing that, then actually I do want to hear about it, because it is something that I also welcome. You know, I talk about feedback as being important for others. I think feedback is also important for my office, and I welcome that too.
Is this on? Yeah. George Talbot-Porras from the Youth Disability Advocacy Service. Speaking of feedback, my feedback to your office is that you have conducted a very thorough examination. We've worked with your staff quite closely and found them very helpful, and also they were willing to investigate some of the individual advocacy clients that that we were working with, and we benefited a lot from your office's support. So there's some feedback for you.
Thank you for that.
And I'm the first to complain when things aren't good, but in this instance, it was very positive. Ever since your recommendations have come out, one of the controversial things that's come out is around where the independent oversight body should sit. Your report recommended it should sit within the Office of the Public Advocate. Advocacy organisations have come out and said, well, a lot of the time we're advocating against the Office of the Public Advocate, so that's not necessarily the right place for it in our view. Since you've heard that feedback, have you developed any further thoughts around the independent oversight body?
Let me make a couple of points on that. What I didn't recommend was that the Office of the Public Advocate be the independent oversight body. I referred to OPA only in the context of advocacy funding. But the independent oversight body, I've made no recommendations actually around where that should sit. And I was asked this question by the parliamentary inquiry, and I was very clear to them, this is a matter for Parliament. There are lots of elements of oversight that sit with various different bodies at the moment. The department does a bit, OPA does a bit, the Disability Services Commissioner does a bit, you know, so the Ombudsman does a bit, you know, so it's not, and I'm not saying, in fact, which of those bodies it should be to be the single independent oversight body. So no, I've deliberately not specified, and I don't think it is a matter for me to specify. It's very much, I think, ultimately a matter for government to determine how it wants to deal with this at a practical level. The recommendation around the funding of advocacy actually is in fact, and I'm aware that advocacy bodies were not keen on that one. It's a much smaller point for me, at least. For me, it's just an issue in principle. It shouldn't be the department. It was the key point I wanted to make in that recommendation, was that the department should not actually be dishing out the funding. So what I said is it should be independent of the department, and that is the important part of it. So I suggested OPA, because it is independent of the department. It doesn't, you know, actually, it's the justice portfolio rather than the DHHS portfolio, because it seemed to be the only logical alternative in there. But whether that's done or not is neither here nor there. You know, the important issue for me are the ones of principle. One, that there should be proper funding for advocacy, and two, that it should sit outside of the department.
That's exactly the question. Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. Now, I'm aware that there has been some confusion around that, and I'm glad of the opportunity to clarify that.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jan from MEDA, Melbourne ACE Disability Advocacy. I'm interested in your perspective as a small, not-for-profit, local advocacy organisation. What measures do you think we could be putting in place to ensure that we not so much put it, respond to the recommendations, but ensure that we are continuing to collaborate and mobilise around safeguarding people with disability in relation to this area of abuse?
I think doing exactly what you're doing now. I mean, the ensure that you're linked in to, you know, to across the sector. The recommendations I've made are very much for government and its agencies rather than to community service organisations, inevitably, because you know they're the ones that I deal with who have an opportunity to do something about it. And sadly, I think, you know, in the absence of leadership from them, you are left very much to your own devices, it seems to me, to determine how best to support the people you need to support. And I think that's a problem. You know, I think it would be so much better if there was clear leadership in the disability sector, you know, in government, so that proper guidance was developed to say, here are some tools that will assist you. And in the absence of that leadership, I think do what you do now. Ensure that you get together, ensure you have these conversations, ensure that you're linked in as much as you can be to the agencies who, you know, like OPA, who do develop materials that that can help.
Thank you, Deborah. It was a fantastic report. My name's Pauline Williams. I work at AMIDA. We're still struggling with, how to sort of recommend changes, and there's still the opportunity because the second phase for the parliamentary inquiry finishes next Friday, taking submissions. One of the things we've been struggling with is that, as you said, over the years, many organisations like yourselves, advocacy services, community visitors, public advocate have made numerous recommendations, but they don't often get picked up, or very little is done, or resources and funding aren't directed in the way they should be. And I suppose even with changes to the structure for oversight, that could continue to happen. And we've seen that in our own advocacy work, that with many cases, things don't shift until there's a forcing of that. So if, for example, an intervention order is put in place and something legally has to be done, then perhaps a place becomes available for somebody to move sideways into another house. But all that does really is shuffle the deck chairs on the Titanic. And so I guess what we're sort of thinking is, well, how do we actually force some change in the system, and where are the teeth? And should we be looking at something similar to, say, the Equal Opportunity Act, where if people are discriminated against, they can go through conciliation but ultimately go to VCAT and have orders made? I mean, are we getting to the point where all of the sorts of oversight bodies that we've tried so far, and they have failed, actually need to be altered in terms of what the mandated changes and the mandate and the laws that we can use to force change are in the system?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Thank you for that. It's you can suddenly get quite cynical in this business, you know, when recommendations are made and lip service is paid to them, nothing actually happens. You know, that's, and I'm seeing a lot of nods about you're used to this kind of thing. I think that there is a real head of steam, actually, around change here. And I think you shouldn't underestimate the power that you all bring to this. You know, this is, you know, you are individually advocates, and collectively, you're a really powerful force. And perhaps what you need to be thinking about more is how you can harness your own power about the kind of change you want to see and how you communicate that. Because that has tremendous effect, actually. And how you do that influences parliamentary inquiries, it influences all kinds of things. And what is, I think, probably the most effective, because governments always look for the easiest possible solution as well as the cheapest, but they will spend money when they have to, when it feels to be an issue of tremendous public importance. And it feels to me that this is an issue that really has engaged with a public consciousness, and you should be capitalising on that. And what I think would be the most effective, and you're the advocates, and it's not for me to tell you how to advocate, but to look at, to come up with the solutions. Look at the kind of recommendations that I'm making, for example, and pick the eyes out of them and say, yes, this is how we see this working. This is where we want this to go. We support mandatory reporting, or we support, this element or this aspect of a single oversight body. This is where we'd like it to sit, and this is where how we think it should engage, and this is where we think these things should work. And present that to parliamentary inquiries, present that to the minister, because your views matter. Don't underestimate them.
Hi, I'm Andrews Castanides, Leadership Plus. On that particular point, I have a suggestion in terms of disability service organisations, and that they need to be registered and this particular code of ethics and protocols in place to ensure that the funding that they provided, they commit to servicing the clients and not disadvantaging the clients deliberately, as I've had to experience in my role as an advocate. So that would be a starting point from my point of view, that especially with NDIS coming in, that organisations are made accountable and transparent in terms of the standards and services that they say to deliver will actually be delivered.
Well, I think that that's got to be a key element, because you've got to, where are the services being delivered? Who is funding those services, and how are they accountable for the delivery of those services is at the core of much of the problem. And what we know so far is that there are all these different systems that depend on the provider. And how is that going to change with the NDIS? Again, we don't know. But yes, identifying the elements of that and saying, look, this is where the safeguards need to be. That's part of the voice that you should be expressing. I encourage that.
Thank you, Deborah. We'll end the questions there. We're just coming up to lunchtime now. Thank you so much, Deborah Glass, Victorian Ombudsman, for taking us through the role of your office and the nature of the phase one of your report. And if you may indulge me in a right of last question to be asked, you mentioned earlier that there will be a phase two report, and I appreciate you're not able to speak to any great detail about that, but can you just give an indication of timeline?
Well, what I've said is before the end of the year, and it's already close to the end of October, heavens above. So, yes, before Christmas.
Fabulous. Thank you. Well, everyone, please join with me in thanking Deborah Glass.